Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And first of all, Happy New Year. I hope Santa brought you all the books you want. And as we begin a third lockdown, it looks like you'll need them. And us, we'll be here. We'll help you through. And we have a wonderfully eclectic show for you today. Our featured guest is Seb Falk, here to talk about his book, The Light Ages. We'll also hear from poets Anna Selby and Daphne Astor about the launch of Hazel Press, a new poetry publisher based in Cambridgeshire. And Mark Dowd talks about his autobiography, Queer and Catholic, about coming to terms with his sexuality and religion. So Seb, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark and Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year to you.
And it's an eclectic show, but you know what? Your CV is quite eclectic too. Just looking through this, you worked at the Home Office, you're a school teacher, a special constable, a yacht master. You now work in academia. Was that where it was always going to go? Was that the route to get there?
No, there's no plan. I just seem to drift and find myself in interesting new places, and I enjoy everything that I'm doing. I want to settle down, but it never quite seems to happen.
And you studied history and the history of science, and that's what you lecture on now. Why that particular subject?
I, again, was never any good at settling to anything, and I hated, when I chose my A-levels, the fact that I had to choose between sciences and humanities, as so many people do. I ended up choosing both, so I did some history and some chemistry and some maths and some Spanish. When I discovered that there was such a thing called history of science, which I didn't discover until I was teaching history, I thought, well, this is the thing for me.
How much scientific and mathematical knowledge do you need to study something like that?
Depends on how you go about it. There are some people who say to understand the competing arguments and the competing theories, you need to completely immerse yourself in the scientific content. There are other people who say, no, look, science is made by societies, it's made by people, it's always influenced by the cultures that people live in. And so actually, it's more important to have a kind of historical mindset. And this debate has been going on ever since the foundation of the subject. Should it be scientists that study the history of science? Should it be historians who study the history of science? You know, there's a place for both. What I kind of wanted to do in my book was to show people how science in the Middle Ages could be complex, could be advanced. And so in order to do that, I had to immerse myself in the content of it. I had to be able to show people how advanced it was. So there's no getting away from that content.
Well, very much looking forward to talking to you about your book, but we'll hear your first choice of music now. Before we hear that, is music important to you, Seb?
Yeah, I was at King's College School here in Cambridge as a little boy, and the choir rejected me. But from that time, music was always part of what I did. There was always music going on. And for me, making music is the really important thing. This track comes from when I started at Oxford and joined a sort of startup a cappella group called Out of the Blue. And we were awful at the beginning, but you know what? We had a great time. We'd go out and busk in the street. We'd get crowds gathering around because we were just engaging. We were having a lovely time. On this track, you can just hear them having fun, and that enthusiasm is infectious, and I think it just makes me happy to listen to it.
I found a switch. You turn it on. That was Love It When You Call by Out of the Blue, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Seb Falk. Seb is a historian, teacher, broadcaster and historical consultant. He teaches medieval history and the history of science at Cambridge University. In 2016, he was named a BBC New Generation Thinker, and his first book, The Light Ages, was published last year. Subtitled A Medieval Journey of Discovery, it illuminates the achievements of scientists, mathematicians and astronomers during the Middle Ages. The Times described it as fascinating and exquisitely written, and BBC History magazine called it stunning. Well, I very much enjoyed it too, Seb. Congratulations. Those are brilliant reviews for your first book. You must be well pleased.
Very pleased. I clearly have an excellent publicist.
Why this subject? Why did you choose to write on this subject?
Well, this came straight out of my PhD, to be honest. My PhD was on astronomical instruments in the Middle Ages. It was quite technical. I wouldn't wish it on anybody to read it. But while I was doing it, I realized that there was such a huge amount that just wasn't part of people's basic understanding about the Middle Ages. I'd always been interested in medieval history. I was into knights and kings and all that kind of thing. And nobody ever said to me that these were people who looked up at the sky and wondered, who made models of the motions of the planets, who calculated to multiple decimal places, or indeed sexagesimal places, as they used a base 60 number system. Like everybody else, I believed that people in the Middle Ages thought the world was flat, but they didn't. Scholars in the Middle Ages knew perfectly well the world was round. And I thought, well, I got to the end of my PhD and I thought, I need to write a book that teaches people some of the incredibly complex understandings that people had about the world around them, but puts it into a proper medieval context so that people can understand how science was part of medieval culture, not a sort of separate subject of study, but really part of the way they thought about the world. So it crops up in Chaucer's poetry, it crops up in art and architecture everywhere. And John Westwick was the perfect guide to that for me.
And let's be clear, first of all, when you speak of the Middle Ages, what period of time exactly are we talking about?
The Middle Ages, as we normally define them, we're talking about Europe, principally, from about 500 AD to about 1500 AD. And the Middle Ages was always conceived as a bit in the middle, a kind of uninteresting bit, a bit not to be bothered with. That's why it was called the Middle Ages by people in the Renaissance who were trying to link their own culture, their own time, with the glories of Greece and Rome. My book focuses mainly on the later Middle Ages because, as I say, I've got this one guy that I'm following, and the book is the story of his life and what he learned and where he went. And so it is focused primarily on Western Europe, on England in about the 14th century. But there's science from the whole of the Middle Ages in there too.
Why was it that particular period of history that you were drawn to?
I'm the kind of historian that loves the stories. People talk about the importance of history as understanding where we come from, and that's true, of course. But also history is a source of great stories. It's a kind of tourism in a sense. You know, the past is a foreign country. It's a bit of a cliche, but if the past is a foreign country, then studying history is like going on holiday somewhere exciting and different and exotic. Why particularly the 14th century? Well, it came out of my PhD research, which was a study of one particular manuscript, which features heavily in the book. And it was a manuscript which had been studied in the 1950s, and lots of theories had been proposed about it, but it hadn't been really resolved and people hadn't really looked at it very much recently. So it was really ripe for further study. And the more I studied it, the more I realised that this would be a good source to hang a history on.
And this book does deal with very complex scientific and mathematical theories. You must have been aware of that when you're thinking you want this to get a wide readership. How you simplify that, how you make that engaging for a reader.
I have to say, a lot of the stuff that I write about, I really struggle to get my head around. There's no substitute for really breaking it down and forcing yourself to really make it step by step understandable from first principles. But at the same time, I also had to convey the complexity of medieval science, because my one really strong argument is that people in the Middle Ages weren't stupid. So in order to show that science in the Middle Ages was complex, I had to give a sense of that complexity. But in order to give a sense of that complexity, I had to kind of take the reader to the brink of confusion and then let them step back a bit. So there are a couple of places where I say, look, if you find this confusing, don't worry, people in the Middle Ages did too. Secondly, I always make sure that if I give the reader a couple of pages of scientific content, then I let them off with an interesting story about people dying on the toilet in a monastery or eating too much and making themselves ill or whatever it might be. So there's a balance of the fun and the hard work in there. So I hope I don't make readers work too hard. But at the same time, it's also about breaking down this whole two cultures myth that is still so powerful, that you can be a scientist or a historian or an artist, but not both. And I'm here to say that, of course, you can be both.
And that was one of the parts of the book that I found really interesting. The fact that Chaucer, for example, was also an eminent scientist and astronomer. I didn't know that.
Yeah, Chaucer wrote a manual for an astrolabe, which was the quintessential medieval scientific instrument, the kind of smartphone of the Middle Ages. And he wrote it ostensibly for his 10-year-old son, Lewis. Now, Lewis probably did exist, but the astrolabe treatise circulated so widely so soon after it was written that Chaucer almost certainly intended it to reach a wide readership. And so Chaucer was communicating science, he was popularising science, but his understanding was absolutely all there. And that's partly, of course, because you didn't need to be a scientist, you didn't need to be a professional to engage with scientific questions in a way that perhaps you do today. But also because science was so much part of medieval culture and the questions that were being asked were relevant to everybody in terms of people who wanted to understand the world around them or people who wanted to understand God's creation for religious reasons.
And the astrolabe, the instrument you described there, which is really at the heart of the book and leads us to John of Westwick, who's our guide to it. Describe to us and tell me why that is such an important instrument. I mean, my goodness, it's complex, isn't it? It's beautiful as well. And if you just tell us what it does and what difference it made.
I'm waving an astrolabe enthusiastically at the microphone here in the hope that your listeners might at least hear it if they can't see it. An astrolabe is a brass disc, usually made of brass. It can be made of other things. And it might fit into the palm of your hand, or it might be as big as, you know, an open hardback book. And it's a disc on which is engraved a kind of map of the heavens. So a grid of latitude and longitude, except it's not latitude and longitude on an astrolabe. It's a grid of altitude, how high something is above the horizon, and azimuth, how far it is around the horizon, like a compass. And on that grid, you've got a kind of cutout of certain stars which circulate. So you can, with the astrolabe, simulate the motions of the heavens. You can simulate the turning of the stars, the rising of the sun. And with that, you can tell the time, you can work out which way is north, you can work out when a certain star will rise, you can identify a certain star. It's got multiple functions. And I say it's like the medieval smartphone because, like a smartphone, it combines the functions of a whole bunch of existing instruments in a really neat little package. So it's not just a calculator, it's not just a computer, it's also a status symbol, it's also an art object, something that people carried around with them to impress their friends or to look clever. And there's also, in all of these astrolabes, there's often a huge amount of artistic skill that goes into making them. So just as people want to buy the latest iPhone because it looks good or, you know, it has different apps or whatever it might be, so astrolabes, the craftsmen who made them, competed with each other to integrate new kinds of designs, new kinds of trigonometrical functions, or to make them beautiful and to incorporate designs from churches and art, really to bring together all of the most prestigious parts of the culture of the day.
And the one you've got there you're holding in your hand, but some of them were huge.
Yes, there's an enormous one called the Sloane Astrolabe at the British Museum, and that is, it must be 45 centimetres wide. It's pretty big. Most of them can be used by one person, so we're not talking modern smartphone, perhaps, in size, except for some of the smaller ones, but certainly the first yuppies mobile phones in the 1980s are comparable.
So these instruments were used to map the movement of the planets, the movement of the sun and the stars, and this was done to understand really the glory of God's creation. That was the motivation at that time.
Yeah, certainly for many people, the idea is that if you are a devout Christian, you want to understand God as well as possible. And there are two books that you can read to understand God in the metaphor of the day. You can read scripture, of course, but you can also read the book of nature. Nature, creation, was evidence for how God worked. So there's no conflict between science and religion, as many people imagine. But the other reason to study the stars, it has to be said, was astrology. Everybody, learned people in the Middle Ages, believed that what happened up in the heavens was a reflection of what was happening down here on Earth. And so again, if you wanted to predict the weather or if you wanted to treat people for medical conditions, it was a good idea to understand what was going on up in the heavens as well.
But the religious motivation would explain why quite a lot of this work was done by monks, quite a lot of the copying out and the original plans.
Absolutely. They had the motivation and they also had the means, because monks had time to study, they had education, they were learned, they were literate, and they had the wealth to obtain books and reading and writing materials, including parchment, which was precious and sometimes very expensive.
And the monk that you follow in particular that guides us through this book is John of Westwick.
The point about John of Westwick is, in many ways, he's kind of an ordinary guy. We don't know a huge amount about him. What we do know was fairly eventful, fairly adventurous. So he's a monk of St. Albans Abbey, one of the wealthiest abbeys in England in the 14th century. At some point, he gets exiled, probably, or sent for one reason or another, up to Tynemouth, which is a daughter house of St. Albans, right on the cliffs overlooking the North Sea at the mouth of the River Tyne. He doesn't stay there very long because he goes off on the Bishop's Crusade, as it's called, to Flanders, and he besieges Ypres. And then he crops up in London. So he goes from place to place. He's not just stuck in one monastery, and he has this kind of eventful, interesting life. But for me, it was really important that he wasn't an outstanding figure, in that so many histories of science are written as these parades of great men, and it is always men in these histories, these kind of isolated geniuses who are portrayed as being ahead of their time. And I wanted to show science doesn't work like that. Science works through a phenomenal team effort. Lots and lots of people are making incremental, tiny contributions.
And as an intelligent man who was interested in studying, entering into the church was ideal because he got the time to do that, access to books and indeed to further education.
It's a good chance he studied at university. So one of the great innovations of the Middle Ages is the foundation of the universities from the 12th century onwards. Oxford University was the first in this country, and it's quite likely that John Westwick would have studied at Oxford. St. Albans was one among several monasteries that sent students to Oxford. They founded their own college for monks called Gloucester College, which is now Worcester College, Oxford. And monks went to study at the university, often not for very long. They often just went for a term or a year, and then they would come back and contribute to the administration of their monastery. So the idea of studying in the university was that it would make you perhaps a better theologian, but perhaps a better administrator, because you could also study law and administration.
Thank you, sir. We'll come back to you in just a moment. We're talking about the church in the Middle Ages. Let's talk about the church today when we hear from Mark Dowd. Mark is an award-winning broadcaster and journalist who has worked for the BBC, Channel 4, The Times and The Guardian. His cutting-edge documentaries reflect his interest in the role of the church and religion in today's world and include Abused and Catholic, Tsunami, Where Was God, and God is Green. His memoir, Queer and Catholic, chronicles his life from growing up as a gay working-class boy in 1960s Manchester to the present day. Nick Robinson described it as funny, moving and powerful. And when I spoke to Mark via a rather dodgy Zoom connection, I started by asking him why he wrote the book.
The book really was based on a film of the same title. We made a film for Channel 4 in 2001 called Queer and Catholic. I'd grown up as a gay man in a Catholic household in the 1960s and 70s in the northwest of England. I joined a religious order when I left university because I wanted to pursue the priesthood. And I just thought it a rather strange contradiction that the Catholic Church formally was teaching that same-sex orientation was something rather inferior and something flawed because of the fact that it can't lead in a relationship to the production of children. And yet here I was in a religious house in Oxford. There were 34 members of my religious community, and I worked out about 28 of them were gay. I thought, well, why is God calling so many gay men to imitate the life of Jesus in the priesthood? Because if this orientation was so flawed and so awful, the last thing God would do would want people like me to represent Jesus in the church, in the sacrament. There have been lots of books that have dealt with the like verses of the Bible, the actual abstract theology of the sexual ethics, but I think a lot of these things are best told through stories. And in a sense, the book of the 10 chapters is the unfolding story of how I've come to terms with it in terms of the relationships I've had with people, but also my parents. My parents were very working class, salt of the earth people who had never really thought about the subject. It was a journey for them as well. And once, I'm pleased to say, my dad always struggled a bit with it. He said, you know, I don't mind you being like you are, but you don't need to tell everyone, do you? Whereas my mum, especially once my dad died, she got a new lease of life. She suddenly started coming to gay Catholic conferences with me, sipping Lambrusco and dancing to ABBA, you know.
Could you have written it while they were alive?
No. Or I could have written a toned down version, some of the more sexual elements. You know, I'm a Catholic after all, and I'm meant to be guilty about all these things, and I don't like talking about these things in front of the family. I'm glad I waited, and if there is a great big book club up in the sky there, and they've had a chance to ponder through it, I hope it's brought a smile or two to their face.
And when you made that documentary all those years ago, in answer to the question, why is the Roman Catholic Church so anti-gay, you said, because it's so gay. Can you explain that? And also, do you think that's still true?
I definitely think it's true. The best thing to do is to think of what it's like if you're a 16 or 17-year-old boy in a Christian family, or particularly in a Catholic family, growing up in the 60s and 70s. You suddenly feel there are young men that you're attracted to, and you're not really attracted to girls. You can't talk about it, and you can't share this with anybody. It's extraordinary how many men interpreted that as a vocation to the priesthood. Can you imagine what it's like in a Catholic priesthood where celibacy is the absolute requirement? You are suddenly spared the most embarrassing questions, because no one's ever going to ask you why you're not going to get married. And of course, there's a sort of slightly in-house understatedness about once you get inside the whole system. So these discussions about vestments and artistic, liturgical aesthetics, if you like, of Catholic life, which is full of imagery and, you know, appeal to as an artistic element. And of course, you don't have to declare yourself, because celibacy, in theory, makes equals of everybody. It doesn't matter whether you're gay or straight or bisexual. You can't get married. You can't have a partner. You have to give your life exclusively to God.
And the book's very funny, lots of funny anecdotes. You don't seem angry.
I'm not going to give up on the church, because, I mean, if you had a car that you really, really loved, had a few problems with it, you wouldn't just get rid of the car. You do its best to kind of keep it on the road and to lovingly try and get it right. And I must keep this issue in perspective. Christianity is a fantastic good news message. I can't let the fact that I'm attracted to men suddenly destroy the essence of that issue, because it would be to get everything out of perspective. It would be like saying, I don't want to buy the car because there's a slight problem with the kind of gearbox. As an oppressed person who's being treated unfairly, you can blow the whole thing out of proportion. That it defines you. There are a lot of gay men and lesbian women who have in the past, once they've come out, gone on and on and on and on about sexual orientation. And sometimes it's a bit tedious for people, because it's like, okay, it's fine. You know, we get it. Let's talk about something else. Sometimes that wound is so deep and so sore for people that they can't let go of it. You know, I'm lucky. I went to a great school. I had loving parents. I've never been beaten up as a result of my being gay. And I've been on the end of a few homophobic insults and funny looks, but I mean, I've not really suffered massively compared with some people. So in a sense, anger has never really materialized, I'm pleased to say.
And what about now? How do you define yourself now in relation to the church? Do you feel welcome there? Do you feel it's a place for you? Do you think it's moving?
It's moving very slowly, but inevitably the laity are way ahead of the clergy, because the clergy have got so much to lose. I mean, I got married, my husband, even 2.5 years ago. The priest knows that I'm gay. He came to the book launch of Queer and Catholic. He doesn't deny me communion when I go there. There are lots of people who are very militant and traditional who'd say that I'm a terrible sinner for having got married. But I'm sure when God looks at human love, he doesn't look at male, female, male, male. He looks at the quality of that relationship. Relationships between men and women, between women. The whole business of cohabiting and sharing space. The same challenges are there for people, regardless of your sexual orientation. There's so much more in common than there is in terms of difference.
And when you were writing this and looking back on your younger self, how did you feel about him?
Falling in love the first time at the age of 15, 16 was like a gift from God. Because it was something that took me out of myself. I knew I would have walked to the ends of the earth for this person. It was the classic, you know, I was writing poetry, I couldn't sleep, I lost my appetite, I thought about him night and day. And I thought, how can this thing be evil and wrong if it has such effects of wanting to give myself to him, to make myself available to him, present to him, support him, listen to him. It took me 2 years even to declare my feelings for this guy. And, you know, it wasn't reciprocated. It was a sense of gift that there is some force beyond myself. And I've never let go of that sense that love is something that comes from beyond ourselves as an invitation to follow. And we fail constantly. We fail in our selfishness and our self-regarding choices and so on and so forth. But, you know, that germ, that sense of what it was about, defined a lot of my future story. I think also I look back at someone who was quite a risk taker. I mean, as a 16-year-old, to find myself in the middle of Manchester on a drizzly November night, trying to find the Thompson's Arms gay pub to go to a meeting of the Campaign for Homosexual Equality, climbing up the stairs and looking at a room full of men in their 40s and 50s. I'm quite proud to have taken those risks.
And Queer and Catholic by Mark Dowd is published by Darton, Longman and Todd. Our featured guest on Bookmark today is Seb Volk, talking about his book, The Light Ages. Seb, we were talking before we heard from Mark there about John of Westwick, and you looked at manuscripts that he'd written and you followed his journey as much as you could. What sense did you gain of him? Did you actually gain a sense of not just of his work, of him as a person?
It's incredibly interesting and frustrating and rewarding, this idea that you can get very close to someone and then not know anything about them for 10 years. I could never feel that I knew him totally, because he disappears from view for large chunks of time and we have no idea what he's doing. And yet in his writings, he's very open about how he's feeling. He wrote astronomical texts. He wrote editions of other people's works. One of the manuscripts that I study is him editing the work of an earlier abbot of St. Albans, Richard of Wallingford, who was a leper who built this phenomenal clock and features in my book. John Westwick is editing these works and he's really struggling to understand them. And we can see him figuring things out and getting frustrated because stuff doesn't make sense. And then when he comes to devise his own instrument and writes about it in Middle English, we see him explaining how to do stuff. So you can get a glimpse of a kind of real master-pupil or teacher-pupil relationship. And then you start to tease out somebody's personality. And yet he will always be mysterious to us because we just lack so many of the details of his life.
Because sometimes when they were copying out, the monks would make little asides. I mean, did he make any of those? Did you get any idea of whether he had a sense of humour, for example?
Certainly in places, you know, he talks about He criticizes his own drawing skills. He says, oh, this is a rubbish drawing. And he gets annoyed with himself, makes mistakes and crosses things out. The scoring there where he's drawn lines through his own work is incredibly deep. He's got very annoyed with himself on a couple of occasions. So you do get a sense of personality, you know, a sense of humour. I think a lot of monks did have great sense of humour. You know, we think of them often as being locked up in their monasteries, only thinking about God. But if you look at the drawings that they did and the stuff they write about drinking, the stuff that they're imagining, they clearly had just as much of a sense of humour as people today.
And when you're writing about him, when you're actually holding a manuscript that he's written, how does that feel?
It's an incredible privilege that I get to go into libraries and hold these 500, 600, 700-year-old manuscripts and think that these were touched by the people whose lives I'm trying to understand, who had very different concerns to us in many ways, but had the same human instincts, the same fears and worries. And it's wonderful that they've left us these physical artifacts. And yes, feeling the hair of the parchment, you know, because this is animal skin, right? This is a real kind of living object. And it's been written on with oak gall ink, ink made from natural products. The interaction between the human and the natural and that huge long space of time that comes between us. And yet it's still there, you know, well preserved.
Well, let's listen to your second choice of music now, which is Ring Out Wild Bells from The Passing of the Year by Jonathan Dove. Why this one?
This is a piece that I sang with Cambridge Chorale, which is a local choir. We've got a fantastic director, Owen Park. We normally do a few concerts every year. We haven't been able to sing as much this year, sadly. We sang this in a concert in 2019, and it's a song cycle by a modern composer, Jonathan Dove, called The Passing of the Year, and he sets poems by people like Emily Dickinson, William Blake. This is the finale, Ring Out Wild Bells, setting those famous lines of Tennyson, "The year is dying in the night, ring out wild bells and let him die." It kind of felt appropriate for the time of year, and I've been listening to it a lot over the last few days. And of course, being Tennyson, it has that sense of optimism despite everything. Ring out old shades of foul disease, ring out the narrowing lust of gold, ring out the thousand wars of old, ring in the thousand years of peace. Jonathan Dove just sets it absolutely beautifully in this really climactic piece, and just the ending, it just sends shivers down my spine, and I loved singing it and I love listening to it.
Let him die.
Cambridge 105 Radio. Kickstart your weekend.
Saturday Breakfast with Matt Webb.
I'm here every weekend to get you moving. I've the latest from the Cambridge News Desk on the hour and half hour. Problems on the A14, Newmarket Road or Mill Road? Well, if there are, you'll be the first to know in the travel. There's a full sports roundup at 8:30, including what's happening at Cambridge United and our other local clubs. Plus a look at the Saturday papers and local online publications at 10 to 9. That's Saturday Breakfast with me, Matt Webb, this weekend from 8.
If you're like me, you've got a family and a business, and you want to protect what's most important when the chips are down. With Woodfine Solicitors, that's exactly what happens. I got a bespoke legal service from a friendly, expert team. They really listened to what was going on and tailored their recommendations to my situation, which was, well, that's another story. Anyway, the best thing was that it all happened online. A few simple clicks and I had my quote. That freed up time to focus on everything else. Get the help you need when you need it most. Visit woodfines.co.uk or call Cambridge 411 421. Woodfines, cutting through the red tape.
What does your home need to feel complete? Gap Home Improvements have been helping customers give their properties that curb appeal for over 20 years. You've seen our vans in your area providing dedicated support to families across Cambridgeshire. Windows, doors, garden rooms, conservatories and warm roofs. We offer free quotations in a pressure-free environment. In person, on the phone or by video call, our consultants will help you realise your property's true potential. Call Cambridge 914 567 or visit gaphomeimprovements.co.uk today.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our featured guest on Bookmark today is Seb Volk, talking about his book, The Light Ages. Seb, when you're writing something like this for a modern readership, how hard is it to convey the importance of religion in the world that you're talking about? Because it is the only game in town, isn't it, in one sense, that everything circles around it and it's used as an explanation for almost everything.
Yeah, it's very tricky because, you know, a lot of what I'm trying to talk about in the book is to show how people in the Middle Ages were in many ways just like us, had similar concerns to us. But this idea that they were living in a providential world where everything was created by God, everything was governed by God, where miracles could and did happen, this is something that we don't engage with today. Even religious people who study science keep those two things separate, by and large. So trying to kind of understand this view that God is everywhere, God is in the world, this is something that I think is extremely hard for people today to get their head around. But the more you read, the more you engage with their different kinds of writing, looking at maps, for example, which show biblical events alongside real places, so that the world is seen as a place where there's this incredible history of God's involvement in the world. They see the world not so much as a collection of inanimate places, but as a place that's filled with spiritual events. It's a really completely different way of thinking about the world.
And as you say, they talk about maps there, and you mentioned earlier our idea that in the Middle Ages they thought the world was flat, and actually it's very clear from these maps that they believe it to be a sphere. Where does the bad reputation of the Middle Ages stem from? Why, and why do we still believe this?
The Middle Ages always was conceived as a period that was not as good as what came afterwards, that right from the Renaissance, people were talking about the Middle Ages as a dark age because they wanted to emphasize how they were recovering the glories of ancient Greece and Rome. And so from the beginning, it was seen as negative and backward. And it was just something that was picked up by later historians, Protestant historians, who wanted to attack the Catholic Church. And that was picked up by anti-religious scientists in the USA. And it's just somehow carried on. And these days, the use of medieval as a slur, medieval now doesn't just mean from the Middle Ages, it also means bad. And that's just the word, and it's almost completely divorced from the meaning of the description of the period. But also there's a sense that people want to disparage a previous period in history in order to feel better about themselves, in order to suggest that we know everything, in order to excuse the sort of complacency that we often have about our own achievements, whether it's our own failure to protect the environment or our own lack of understanding of certain things. And if this last year has taught us anything, it's that we're not as knowledgeable, we're not as all-powerful in our world as we sometimes like to think we are. And I think perhaps a little bit of humility might come from reassessing or reimagining some of the achievements of people in the past.
And maybe learning, as you say, that science and humanities can be together, which they very much are, whereas now they feel quite distinct. We've mentioned Chaucer. You also quote the poet John Gower quite considerably.
I wanted to include as much poetry as I could. There's poetry in five different languages in there, Arabic poetry, Latin poetry, and science was absolutely part of learned culture. There's a sense of, oh, you have to leave science to the scientists. It's not possible for people to really understand it. So we swing between this utter disparagement of experts and then this hero worshipping of experts, and neither of them is healthy. You know, when governments claim to be following the science, we need to understand what it is that they mean by that, because no scientist who is thoughtful about what they do would ever admit that there's just one science. You know, science is a competing marketplace of ideas, if you like. And a better understanding of how science really works and how science has worked in the past would, I think, be healthy for everybody.
Thank you, Seb. Well, let's stay with the idea of poetry for now. Hazel Press is an independent publisher based in East Anglia, launched at the end of last year. It publishes poetry, essays, and interdisciplinary work. I spoke to the founder, Daphne Astor, about her reasons for establishing a new publishing house, along with poet Anna Selby, whose collection Field Notes was one of the first books to be published by Hazel Press. Anna began by reading a poem from that collection.
What happens to your heart? It goes like this. You'll be floating. Your skin will become thirst. Submerge your face. A metamorphosis starts, blood retreats, heartbeat slowing, your mind an almost state. If you choose, dive. The transformation grows. You become water, mammalian. On land, the equivalent pressure kills. For the first few feet, your lungs are buoys. Afterwards, contracting air shrinks you. Go deeper. You swim into a gravityless space. Here is where the ocean stops pushing you away. Further, the pressure trebles, the master switch kicks, your heart ticks even slower. Below, it plummets, 14 beats or lower. You should be unconscious. Your chest size halves, organ walls work as release valves. Now, turn back up. Everything switches, reinflates, races. You are land again, of and on. Your heart broke laws.
I turned 70 last December, and I thought very long and hard about how I wanted to spend the next 10 years of my life and what my focus would be. So we're based entirely in East Anglia, have a real connection to the land, and we publish poetry, essays, interdisciplinary work. It's generally about the environment, feminism, and the arts. Anna, very luckily, became a lodger just at the beginning of COVID as she needed a place to shelter. So she has been a consultant on this project since the beginning.
Poetry is kind of explosive almost. It's this thing that you can turn to and that I feel people turn to at key moments in their life. This time of maybe being more inward and insular and not being so busy with so many outward things has given people that extra bit of time to read, but also it's one of the first major existential crises that we've had. So potentially that's another reason why people turn to these work that has incredible depth and roots and compactness, and is about ways of looking and experiencing the world.
All throughout my life, I've believed in working in friendship, and the covers are created by someone called Phil Goss, and I've known his work for many years. We also care very much about sort of cleaving to our beliefs. For instance, the typeface is called Mrs. Eves because we wanted to have a woman-designed typeface. We also asked a friend in Cambridge, Lita Kindersley, about designers because we want only to use local people if possible. And she said, yes, Dale Tomlinson is who she works with. And we then really, really looked into printing. What are the environmental impact issues in printing? And miraculously, the only carbon positive printer in all of the UK is in Beccles in Suffolk. He always only uses vegetable dyes. He always only uses UK recycled paper, so there's no mileage in the recycling.
It is exactly how it should be for an environmental press and for environmental work to make as least damage as possible to the environment. It feels wonderful rather than writing about the environment and feeling very strongly about protecting the environment, but then making something that harms it. It doesn't feel right. So to have something that is climate positive and with the publisher and printing press that for decades has been environmental and one of the leaders in the field, it feels really good.
I'm looking for things that have heart, but with this particular quartet that Hazel's begun with, I had a friendship with Matthew Hollis and loved his work. Anna, I really didn't know. We had connected through environmental things and poetry. And as I was starting, I said, you know, can I read some of your work? I was astounded. I was thrilled and astounded. Sean Borrowdale is a wonderful poet, and I've had a long interest in Sylvia Plath. And he had this very deep and intuitive and fascinating essay that I asked him if he would be willing to publish. He's never published an essay before. He's only ever published poetry. Ella Duffy was recommended to me by a friend. And my goodness, she's exciting. She very kindly said that writing Rootstock got her through the through the first lockdown because she became completely entranced as she was writing. I'm going to miss working with this quartet of people. I already miss being involved with editing and thinking about their work. They're just astonishing, each of them. And together, they make something quite magical.
Flowers in the volcano. What isn't saved is gone. The man says, who's walked through the night with me to the lip of this volcano. A track of wounds left in the scree. Our footprints shining. At my feet, the impossibility of three purple violets shaking in the dark.
Poetry publishing has always struggled as sort of rather like drawing does with visual art. You know, oh, we want to buy paintings. Ah, but drawings, they're quieter, smaller, perhaps more intense. And it's true also with poetry, but it's on the up. People are reading poetry like mad. And it's also particularly well suited to the internet. There's wonderful, wonderful online magazines and online launches and readings that have gone on since last March. So I feel very optimistic about poetry.
I absolutely feel optimistic, and I always have. And I read a lot of international work as well, and poetry in translation. So I have in my head not just this tiny island that I live on, but globally how much people revere and respect, and poetry is part of their everyday lives.
Hazel is entirely handmade. I mean, we sit here, Anna comes and goes. It's something very true about making something in a time of crisis. And it's been a privilege to be focusing on this and to literally have our hands in it. I mean, we have recycled envelopes. We have an old-fashioned seal that we put on the envelopes.
We want it to be tactile, and it's just so lovely to get kind of written post with little details and touches that I don't know, they're especially nice during the lockdown to get things that human hands have touched and put together. And
yeah, it's true. We try and send something out to people that will in some way enhance their lives at this time. And I do think poetry always almost does that. It's needed. It's needed.
The still round pool by the Atlantic Ocean. No one goes in the still pool. Englishmen lie beside it, retired men with their stomachs easing to each side, cloud bathers. Part of me admires their determination. Gammon, an aunt calls them, sausages. These pinking, swelling men who fly to cheap islands, arranging their sunbeds like dried petals, shouting at screens and singing in the dark. The waves reach up to them, bolt and smack into each other on their way back. The bathers move their beds again. High tide, low tide, neap tide. Nothing moves in the pool except the rain, which comes rarely. When it does, it begins as dropped spinning tops, a rug of shocked thoughts, ripples, ohs, and exclamations. Poltergeist fish coming back to the surface, opening every jar of water for their air.
And you can find out more about Hazel Press, including details of Anna Selby's poetry collection Field Notes, at hazelpress.co.uk. Our featured guest on Bookmark today is Seb Falk. He's been talking about his book The Light Ages, which is published by Alan Lane. What's next for you, Seb? I mean, this book's been very successful. What's next for you? You're an academic. Are you going to write something else?
I wish I knew. This is the book I really felt I had to write. I have a few other ideas, mostly sticking within the Middle Ages, because it's such a fascinating period, and a period which, at least for the history of science, is not very well understood. But I'm a teacher. Teaching is always kind of at the heart of what I do and may well lead me somewhere else. And of course, right now, I'm teaching my own children, stuck in homeschooling lockdown, not much time for writing books at all.
Yes, well, I know our last choice of music that you've selected very much references your children. But before then, a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark. What are you reading at the moment?
I've just started Square Haunting by Francesca Wade, the story of a square in London where five pioneering women writers lived. One of them was Eileen Power, who was a fellow of Girton College, where I was a fellow for the last few years. And so I've kind of picked it up partly for that. It's absolutely fascinating on the lives of these women. I'm also reading a poetry collection I've got by my bedside by Sean Hewitt, Tongues of Fire, and it's just wonderful, so wonderful on the relationship between humanity and nature and metaphors around water and trees, and it kind of feels good for the time of year. There's a lot of darkness and winter and fallen leaves and things, and so I'm really enjoying that.
Thank you, Seb. Well, we'll come back to you for that lovely last choice of music in just a moment. But a heads up that on our next show, our featured guest is nature writer Mark Cocker, talking about a former East Anglian Book of the Year, A Claxton Diary. We'll also hear from novelist Jill Dawson on being a judge for the Costa Book Awards. And poet Hannah Walker will talk about being artist in residence at the Cambridge Biomedical Campus. But we'll sign out now, Seb, with your last choice of music, which is Sleeping Bunnies. This is a blast from the past for me. Shake, Rattle and Roll.
Yeah, this might be familiar to a few listeners. One of the main kinds of singing I've done in recent years, certainly during lockdown, was singing to my children. They loved Shake, Rattle and Roll, which is a local music group. We bought their CDs and this was compulsory listening in the car. And so, of course not in the car, but whenever they hear it at other times, my children will hop along like the bunnies and lie down on the floor and pretend to sleep. So this one means a lot.
See the little bunny sleeping till it's nearly noon.